Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Securing Bridges podcast. You're about to join Alyssa Miller as she sits down with senior and executive security leaders to share stories of success and failure while working across business teams. It's time to build and secure the bridge to the business. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
All right, Securing Bridges fans, here we are once again. Thanks for joining us. Another episode of, well, hopefully your favorite show, my favorite show. I'm biased, though. So good to see you all out there. I hope you're ready for yet another wonderful guest. We are into February. We're cruising along here. How's your month going so far? We're having fun here. And like I said, we've got another great guest today. I'm really excited for this one. I cannot even believe that I get this opportunity to have this next person on our show, but he's here. He's with us. Everybody say hi. It's Jerry Bell. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Alyssa. How are you doing?
I am doing wonderful. It is very good to see you. And as I said, I'm quite honored to have you on the show. It's been a while in coming from my perspective, working through like my wish list of guests I wanted to have on there, but you were on there too. So, but for those out there in our viewing land who maybe don't know you, go ahead and just introduce yourself. Tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. So, gosh, where to start? Currently, I am the CISO for IBM's cloud business, which keeps me pretty busy. For about the past 12 years, I've run a little podcast called Defensive Security with a good friend of mine, Andy Callett. Most recently, my claim to fame has been a Mastodon instance called infosec.exchange, which has been where a lot of the security community has rehomed post Elon Musk apocalypse on Twitter.
The Elon Musk apocalypse. That's probably the best description I've heard of it yet. Yes, you know, Mastodon has become the refuge for many of us, and many of us have found our way to that instance. Certainly, you know, I'm there, as people know, and it's been a great place. So, but you also said, so let's start at the beginning. You mentioned IBM, and you know, so CISO for IBM Cloud. What does that actually like mean? What does that entail? Because I think people kind of wonder sometimes when you're like the CISO of a product, that's a little, you know, I have some ideas, but share with us if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, sure. So IBM has a public cloud, so similar to what you might find at AWS or Azure or Google. It's obviously smaller, and it derived from some acquisitions IBM made about 10 years ago. And while it is a commodity cloud, so for you know it does compete directly with those other providers, it's really focusing on our niche customers, IBM's niche customers, which are the really large, complex multinationals with high regulatory expectations and whatnot. So, in terms of what my role is, I am responsible for defining the security strategy and policy, making sure that we are, offering our customers a secure place to run their workloads.
Okay. All right. So definitely more of like, I don't know how to put this, like an internal role of like you're responsible for the security of that cloud environment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's right.
Yeah. So do you like then, does that put you in a position too, where you're talking to like customers and stuff and their security teams or anything like that, as far as either A, trying to justify your security strategy within that cloud environment, or B, helping them understand how to, you know, kind of where I guess that shared responsibility line falls and who's responsible for what?
Yeah, it's primarily the latter. you know, again, a lot of our customers tend to be more sophisticated, right? We see a lot of banks, large sophisticated companies who are, you know, perhaps more conservative than like a, you know, somebody that was born on the cloud. And so one of the things we have to do in those instances is, you know, obviously convince those customers that, you know, we have a responsible security program in place. And similarly, by the way, we have to have those same sorts of discussions with regulators.
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned lots of regulated customers and banks. So that right away to me screams, you know, having come from financial services many years myself, we start talking financial services and the regulatory side of it definitely, you know, starts to show up. But you said something that was kind of interesting there. It sparked a thought for me. You mentioned that these are, you know, more of your conservative type organizations. They're ones that aren't necessarily cloud native organization or, you know, infrastructure, that sort of thing. They weren't born in the cloud, I think is how you put it. Do you find that like the people you're talking to, are they like set on like a cloud transformation journey, as some would say, or is it more that they're just sort of kind of more organically growing into it?
I think it's more of the former. So, you know, a lot of organizations around the world right now are for a variety of reasons, trying to take advantage of cloud. And so, you know, it's not a situation where we don't have, you know, born on the cloud companies coming to our cloud. It's more that, you know, that they tend to be more comfortable and less resistant to it, so to speak. But you know, for the larger companies, you know, there is a recognition of the you know, the business advantage that you have from moving from a traditional on-prem data center to the cloud. And so I think a lot of these customers see the writing on the wall, and they're trying to participate in the modern economy and see the need to make those sorts of moves.
Okay. And that makes sense. I mean, it's because I've seen both organizations I guess there's kind of three, right? There's those, you know, again, that you're working with who just, you know, that's where they started. They started with cloud tech. That's where they've, you know, begun their lives. Everything they're doing is cloud native. They've learned that ecosystem. They build into it well. You've got those who make a very specific focus transition to cloud, that cloud transformation story. And then you've got kind of those who, you know, sort of find their way there, maybe because their business sort of drives them there in certain cases. So when it comes to then that defining, I guess, that line, when we talk shared responsibility in terms of cloud, and do you find that to be well understood with these organizations, or is that like a conversation that you're having to get into with a lot of them still, where they don't even, maybe they've got different expectations of what cloud providers should be doing than what, you know, cloud providers are actually offering in terms of, you know, whether it's management of the environment or the security of the environment or whatnot?
Surprisingly, I think a lot of organizations are pretty, you know, they understand the nuts and bolts of cloud. And so I don't typically have to do a lot of education in that regard. Right. So it tends to be more on the edges, right? Where you have maybe higher up the stack type applications, software as a service, or where customers may want to offload more of the operational responsibilities. So typically a lot of the larger companies recognize, you know, their business isn't about managing IT. Their business is about, you know, managing a bank or making cars or what have you. And so, you know, they're very interested in not only moving to the cloud, they're also interested in partnering with a company that can, you know, that can help, you know, both manage that transformation, but also manage the IT ongoing. So, you know, it's often in context of a partner as well.
Gotcha. So understanding their business then kind of becomes key, because a lot of times they're asking you to take on a little bit more of maybe an operational role or something. You're going to have to understand what it is that is meaningful to their business and how do you kind of prioritize those efforts.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, certainly IBM used to be big into that part of the business prior to our divestiture of a company now that's named Kyndryl. Mm-hmm. But they're still a very large partner of ours, and we love them. And I think hopefully they love us our joint customers hopefully love us both.
Cool. So how does one end up becoming the CISO of, you know, IBM Cloud, right? I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there who watch this show who maybe have aspirations or maybe just wonder, like, how do I even end up in a role like that? So now we're asking about origin stories, right?
so certainly luck in being in the right spot at the right time has a lot to do with it. I'm not going to lie about that at all. But for me, you know, I started off, didn't have really any aspirations to be in IT. I wasn't in a financially sound place as I was growing up, and really couldn't afford to go to college. I started working out of school, out of high school. I did attend a little bit of college, but ran out of cash. So I started working at a factory, and I learned an incredible amount at that job. It was a really hard job, but I was there. I was the IT person for a factory, and I kind of grew into that role. This was in the very early 90s.
Okay.
And I learned about networking, about programming, about system administration, and it kind of gave me a broad understanding of IT. And then from there, I went to a small ISP, which was bought by a security company called Internet Security Systems. And I rose up through the ranks there, and I was never really on a security trajectory. At that point, I was more of on a CIO trajectory.
Gotcha.
And it wasn't until IBM bought Internet Security Systems that, for a variety of reasons, I got tagged as the security guy. I was challenged with a lot of different roles. One of the great things about IBM is, it's a fantastic company. Like it's just a great place to work. And there are many, many different types of opportunities. And I had the good fortune of a lot of leaders who took me under the wing and exposed me to different things, including, managing different aspects of regulatory programs and, getting into security incident response and policy design and whatnot. And so, it's one of those deals where, like, in hindsight, I can kind of look back and see the rotational assignments that I was being given to prepare me ultimately for what I got to. But it was right place at the right time. There was an opening. The business unit that I was that I'm in now, they're again focused on these highly regulated institutions, and I have a lot of experience in dealing with regulators from my prior experience. So, plus I've kind of gotten the experience of being a security leader. So it was a bit of a natural fit. By the way, I'm not saying that, that I'm the best CISO that there ever was. It is it is something that I continue to learn every day.
Oh, if somebody wants to claim that title of best CISO that ever lived or something, please don't call me. I don't want you on the show. anybody who would lay claim to that is probably one, telling on themselves, but two, probably not the personality I want to hear from. I think if we're not all learning, that's, and we don't believe that we're always learning, you know, we probably aren't doing a very good job. So, you know, it makes sense to me too. So, you know, being engaged in the cloud business at IBM for someone who was, as you said, kind of on that CIO track where it's definitely about the technology and mm-hmm. understanding, you know, how we build infrastructure and what drives different technology needs. I'd have to imagine that plays into pretty well your position now where you're in charge of a cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly so. It was a fortuitous thing. You know, it was for a long time, I've expected cloud is where a lot of the IT industry is headed. And I know that might be an unpopular position, but, you know, we don't manage our own voicemail systems anymore. We don't have our own power plants. And I think over time, a lot of IT, a lot of corporate IT is going to end up consolidated in the cloud. And, you know, it might not be as, in 50 years, it might not be as, you know, cutting edge and innovative as it is today. But, you know, I think that's where the industry is headed. And so, you know, from my perspective, it's always been something I've been really interested in because since I got into IT leadership back in internet security systems, like I could see that end destination. I had no idea how far away it is, but to be part of it is just super exciting.
Well, there was kind of a natural progression of it too, right? Like you saw these companies that had big data centers, then they started, you know, paying third parties to host their data centers. Then it got into colo situations and it did sort of progress all through like the 90s and early 2000s, it felt like to me. But so, you know, I kind of had a laugh because you said the same thing that I've heard from so many security people in all directions, right? Is, well, I kind of got here by accident. And it's, my version of that is I tell people, yeah, it was like a series of serendipitous events. Like there was, you know, happy little accidents happen. But I think, and let me know if you agree with this. I've tried to tell people to, you know, because I think people hear that and they're like, oh, well, you just, you know, what if I don't get lucky? Then I'm, you know, I'm kind of screwed or whatever. What I've been telling people is I feel like it's, everybody has the opportunity to get lucky at some point. Opportunities show up, mm-hmm. but not everybody recognizes it, or not everybody is always willing to jump for it. And I think, you know, as much as yes, there are just circumstances that happen to us, it's what you do when those circumstances happen oftentimes that really drives whether or not, you know, you kind of progress to where you want to go or not. I mean, how do you feel? I mean, am I on the right track with this or am I nuts?
100%. I mean, no, look, I'm not going to say, you know, look, the reality is there's millions of people in IT and there are a far fewer number of CIO and CISO jobs out there. So like, obviously not every one of us is going to get a job like that, but I think you said it pretty well. There is a lot to say about you know, self-management, I guess is one way to say it. But I, you know, one of the things I always tell people that I mentor is to be the one that helps embrace change, because you know, a lot of organizations, and this is kind of what I think has worked for me. You know, businesses go through change, right? They go through periods of rapid growth, through contraction, through, you know, diversifying, through consolidation, through acquisition and divestiture. And, you know, being part of that and supporting the mission rather than resisting it, I think is a huge, you know, a huge differentiator of people that that senior leaders see as leaders versus, you know, just more, you know, worker bees, I guess. And that has, I think worked for me pretty well, just helping to embrace and drive that change, facilitate the change, as well as kind of much more boring things like, you know, live up to your promises. Like do what you say and say what you do. There's some pretty boring basics that just that are pretty important.
Yeah, and I mean I don't want to discount either that there, you know, some people struggle, you know, have more obstacles in their path. Let me put it that mm-hmm. way than others, right? I mean, and don't anyone who I'm sitting here saying like everybody gets their lucky breaks and whatever. I understand and fully acknowledge that for some people, you get more than others in terms of those opportunities, those lucky breaks. But what you said that I loved is this idea of, you know, help the organization embrace change. Because as, you know, I think it's pretty commonly understood now that if an organization doesn't continue to evolve and innovate and do new things, they kind of die and fall behind. And probably in the opposite order, they fall behind and then die. But, you know, it's hard when organizations try to change because you do have people who are established in a way and they want to defend a way that things have been done. And when you can be that person that helps something change and you can be the advocate for a change that's meaningful and expands the business somehow or grows the organization or creates some new innovative product, you sort of become the face of that and you're the one that people will remember later on.
100% right. Yep.
So, I mean, I wish I had interviewed you before I wrote the book because that is something, I mean, if you're out there watching and you're thinking about how to progress your career, if there's anything at all you want to latch onto from this episode, that's the thing. I feel like that is probably one of a great nugget. I've never really thought of it that way before. But you also mentioned that there's a finite number of CIO and CISO positions out there that is much smaller than the number of IT professionals. Mm. And the one thing I thought about that, and I'm kind of curious, how did you decide that type of role, management role, leadership role, you know, especially executive role, how did you make the decision that was right for you or where you wanted to go?
I would love to say that it was the product of a lot of, you know, contemplation and self introspection, but it was not. It was sheer giddiness when somebody, you know, made the opportunity available to me. And you know, look, it is an interesting thing, especially when you make the jump to management and then you start working your way up the executive ranks, you do make trade-offs and you make some significant trade-offs, right? I mean, from obviously the rewards are good. Like I cannot complain about pay in any way, but you trade off aspects of your life. You trade off family time, you trade off hobbies, you trade off many things. One of the hardest things for me to trade off was being technical.
Oh.
Right? And candidly, this kind of folds back to why there is an InfoSec.exchange.
Okay, because, now I'm curious. This I want to hear.
Because you know, I felt like that part of my brain was atrophying. And it is my tie to technology. And by the way, I think that's a virtuous thing because if you spend all of your time in leadership and obviously when you go up the executive ranks, you have to continue to hone your abilities there, right? I mean, it's a career. It requires skills just like any other job, and you have to get better at those. But I really think from a CISO's perspective, it's important to have a deep understanding and continue to have a deep understanding of like the technology and not get too far away for a variety of reasons. One is so like, you know, at the end of the day, like the buck stops with you. Like when you're a CISO, the buck stops with you. People say that, you know, all hell breaks loose. Who are they going to come and talk to you? Right. They come and talk to you.
That's true.
And you,
yes.
you really have to have a deep understanding of technology. You can't always punt to the people under you. You have to have an understanding, and so that's my way of doing that. One of the reasons I do it. The other reason I do it is I just love the community aspect, and I feel like I'm making a difference. But you know, that's how it started, at least. I mean, InfoSec.exchange started about, gosh, it's almost 6 years ago, and that was long before I was a CISO. But I was an executive at the time, and I felt myself becoming kind of floating away from technology.
Yeah, no, and I hear this. I love this because there's the trade-offs, first of all, are something I'm glad you highlighted, because I think, and it's kind of our own fault, I think, because we don't do, there's not a great like career progression map for cybersecurity, but you know, there's a lot of people in cybersecurity who just by de facto, I guess, believe that, okay, well, after I get to a certain level, I have to go into management if I want to keep progressing. And I think it's important that people understand that you know, becoming this a CISO or any executive level title isn't necessarily the foregone conclusion or the measure of success. It might be, but there are specific skills that are very different than you're doing in, you know, if you're, you know, working in the technology day to day. It's a very different skill set. And, so I try to highlight that for people that you don't have to go into management to keep accelerating. I mean, there are some people out there, security architects I know who are making as much as I am as a CISO. And It's because they've been in it a long time. They know all the different technology. And so there are those career paths to go that don't have to end in management.
That's right. It's about the value that you add to the business. Absolutely.
So I guess where I want to go from there then is, you know, you mentioned InfoSec.exchange. And you started it 6 years ago. It's been there. I don't know how populated it was per se, but obviously in the last 6 months, it has changed immensely. So kind of what has that even been like, as Twitter kind of went the way it went with a certain unnamed individual who's taken over and made some decisions.
It's been fascinating. It has been absolutely fascinating. So for the first 5 years, we had, I think there were something around 3,000 accounts had been created, but there were less than 200 people active in any given month. So it was really, really sparse. I ran it in a VPS that cost me a couple hundred bucks a year, and it was fine. I kept up with a small community of people. It kind of scratched my technology itch. And then fast forward to right around this time last year when the news broke about the potential acquisition of Twitter, and there was an initial exodus to InfoSec.exchange at that time. And it killed my VPS. it swamped my boat. And I ended up having to buy what I call a big boy server. And it was a server at the time, I thought, by the way, that I would never outgrow. It was 32 core, 128 gig at NVMe SSDs. And it was a significant piece of hardware. And then fast forward to October, late October. I was working from my place at the beach, and my phone started going bananas. I have the Twitter alerts set up on my phone, and it just started going crazy. And I was on a meeting, and I couldn't look at my phone for a while. I eventually looked at it, and it was just like dozens and dozens and dozens of mentions from Twitter. And they was people referring each other to InfoSec.exchange and mentioning me. And I looked at, went and looked at the Mastodon instance, and, we went up by a couple of thousand people in the first day, and then another 1,000 or two the second day. And that was pretty cool. The server was doing great. No problem. I was excited to see it and fairly encouraging of it. I had no idea how many people would ultimately move, though. And so about a week in to 2,000 to 3,000 people joining per day, I started to realize I was in trouble.
I can only imagine. I mean, I think of just the happy horror of, holy crap, millions of people are joining my, holy crap, millions holy of people crap. Are joining my instance.
that was exactly my predicament. And so so I got to spend a lot of quality time when I wasn't working. So in the middle of the night, weekends, whatnot, I actually took some time off of work. And I learned a lot more about scaling Linux. And I learned a lot more about how Mastodon is built and how to scale it out. And I spent a lot of effort and money in scaling this thing up. And we had a couple of little rough spots, but the objective I set out for myself, other than just figuring out how to do it, like the technical challenge of figuring out how to do this was so cool to me. But I really wanted. I love the community that is on the Fediverse and Mastodon, and I've loved it since before this episode. And I wanted, I wanted that feeling for other people in the security community, and so I wanted to be the front door for people who wanted to leave Twitter and go somewhere else, and to have a landing spot that just worked and was, not drama free. It just worked. And, the reality of Mastodon and the Fediverse is that it's highly decentralized. It's federated. It's why it's called the Fediverse. And I know that people aren't going to stay, right? They're going to pick up and move to other instances. They're going to start their own instance, Kevin Beaumont, for example, started his own. He initially came over and started his own, and that is the beauty of it, right? And so for me, it was all about trying to keep that community intact.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting to me because, I was on an earlier instance and it never, no way was there. And then all of a sudden, I think for me, it was Leslie Carhart, tweeted something about, hey, we're all going to InfoSec Exchange. And I'm like, I'm there. If that's what we're doing to get away from Musk, I'm on it. And, but I heard a lot of people say, well, it's just like IRC. And I was like, no, this isn't like IRC. This is nothing like IRC. But I'll tell you what, as I've gotten more used to the how the Fediverse works and the federated instances, and I start to see what people mean, because does it operate the same way? No. IRC, you had, like, for me, it was undernet and a bunch of different channels I could join and whatever, but individual channels could be secured and not talk to each other, and it's different in that sense. But I think that overall decentralized nature of it is what people are referring to. And to me, it's almost like, I think Mastodon, as I've seen it thus far, maybe this is me being optimistic and idealistic, but it's the closest we've come to what we all thought the internet was going to be back in the 90s when this thing first came to us. And we were all excited because it was this whole new world of whatever. And I think people kind of forgot on Twitter why we all originally gravitated to Twitter, because Twitter started to do things that we didn't originally want to deal with, like paid ads and, the infamous algorithm and all that kind of stuff, things that, Mastodon doesn't do. Right. And I think that's, now we've started to see, like, oh yeah, the people who are on, you know, Mastodon now, I think are the ones who are realizing like, yeah, this was what we always liked when back in the day with Twitter, if you will. And so I assume for you then, you know, because that love of the community is also something that speaks deeply to me. I assume that this has got to be, you know, a kind of a proud moment in that sense for you to be able to be just one part of, you know, this thing that has happened now.
I don't know if it's proud as much as honored, like just to be part of that has been just one of the coolest things. Obviously I have kids and I'm married and whatnot. So those are obviously above, but been one of the coolest things that I've been part of. And I'm so happy to have been part of keeping the community coalesced. And it's so cool to watch people converse and ideas form and connections be made and people sharing, you know, job leads. And I mean, it's just an awesome thing. And to have the ability to be part of that is just a big honor.
Well, we've had a number of people pop up and thank you. And I'm going to share my own thanks because truly for me as well, I mean, this community means a lot to me. I grew up in the IRC days. I didn't get into BBS so much, but I was, you know, I was in the hacker rooms on IRC and you know, that was my teenage years for me. And so, of course, you know, years when I was pretty awkward and whatever anyway. And that's where I learned to really appreciate the security community or what eventually became part of the security community. And so, you know, for me, it's been great having that feel come back with Mastodon. So little side note to just say, really, really appreciate it. It is, you know, it has been a good refuge for a lot of people. I just talk, well, hell, I'm not supposed to do this. You're never supposed to talk about what you talked about before the show. But hey, you know what? Newsflash, we talked before the show. You know, you and I were talking about just every time now that I still get sucked back to Twitter, I'm trying to stay away from things like the trending topics because you just know there's going to be some doom scrolling moment in there that's going to suck you in.
It's a rage machine.
And that's the problem with the algorithms, right? Is that's what they're designed to do, is to reward those things that get people fired up and screaming at each other. And I think it probably has a lot to do with why maybe some of our, you know, other societal discourse goes the way it does.
100%. And so I think I've seen and talked with a lot of people that have made the move from Twitter to Mastodon, and then some have moved back. And you know, some people love, absolutely love the fact that it's chronological, I guess, is an algorithm, so to speak. But yeah, there's a lot of people who really appreciate that. You know, it is, you know, on Mastodon, it's time based, right? You know, mm-hmm. the timelines are solely driven by time. There's no attempt to show you things that some algorithm thinks that you might engage with. But on the other hand, there are people who clearly like that, and the fact that it isn't there, they feel like they're missing out. And so, you know, I've seen people, you know, move back, but for the people that are there, I think it is the right place, right? Yeah. It is, and that's what's so awesome about it, is the community of people that are formed, that have formed there. They want to be there and they like it.
No, and that's, and I, the FOMO thing, I will admit, you know, it took me a little while to, I realized how conditioned I got by Twitter. And then I started to think back on, I remember living through the days of Twitter as the algorithm slowly started to take over more and more. And more often, you know, my timeline made less and less sense to me because it wasn't chronological. And I would all of a sudden get a tweet in my timeline that was like 5 days old. And I'm like, why am I seeing this? Oh, because, you know, it's got a few hundred thousand likes on it now. So it's showing up again. And so it does, you know, there was a moment there where I felt like, oh, damn it, I got to be like watching this thing every minute. But then you start to figure it out and you start to figure out, well, I can use hashtags. I know the people I want to hear from. I can scroll back. I can set up alerts. I can do all the things so that I see the information I want to see when I want to see it. But it, the timeline makes more sense when it is just chronological because I can follow that. I know why I'm seeing something. And so I think that that's, to your point, though, I think so many people have gotten conditioned by social media platforms. And it doesn't matter if we're talking Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, they all do it. And mm-hmm. Mastodon is the only one I know of that doesn't.
Yeah, and I suspect, I don't, obviously I have no metrics or no way of proving this, but at least for me, I spend less time like browsing Mastodon, browsing timelines on Mastodon. And so, you know, to that end, I think, you know, maybe there is an adjunct benefit of like, it gets us back into the real world a little bit more than, you know, because again, Twitter and Facebook and all the others, like they are engineered, intentionally engineered to keep you, you know, looking at that app for as long as possible.
Yeah. That's what gets some ad revenue. That's the whole point of it, right? I mean,
we don't have that. I have no metrics. I don't have people asking me how many, you know, was there more people or less people that visited the site last month? Like, I don't care. The only metric I have is like, are people enjoying themselves? And are they having a good time? Or are they learning? Or you know, am I doing a good job at being a host? That's my bar.
So I do want to point out, because we have the opportunity right now, that to that end, it's not supported by ads. It is supported by ultimately you, but people have a way to help support that. So can you please share that? Because I am a contributor and I would like other people to understand that they can be a contributor and help as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. It is supported by donations. And, you know, I've been adding lots of other services. So like we've got a video service and a picture service and a blog and I keep adding more things. And so I'm trying to, I'm trying to build out the community here. And so it does cost quite a lot of money. I have a couple of different ways that you can support. I have a Patreon, so it's patreon.com/infosecexchange. There's a Ko-fi, and I'm blanking on the link because I wasn't ready for that. And then also PayPal is my email address. Jerry@infosec.exchange is my PayPal address.
Okay. Well, I mean, so yeah, I apologize that I surprised you with that, but to me, it's important.
No, thank
because, you. You know, again, this has, as you know, was being mentioned here in the comments, this has become a haven for so many people that, you know, it's important that, hey, you know, if you can, if you're able, please do go help and, you know, become a contributor. I think I use the LibrePay. That's another one that's out there.
Oh, yeah, LibrePay.
Let's see if I can do this. Yes, there we go. I know how to use StreamYard. So there's the Ko-fi link. Otherwise, just go to Jerry's page, you know, add Jerry on infosec.exchange and check it out. So the last thing, one final plug, because we're running over on time, but that's okay. I want to talk about your podcast really quick. Defensive Security Sure. Podcast. And so tell us just a little bit about that. What you know, who are your guests? What do you talk about?
Yeah, so it's we really don't have guests. It's a good friend of mine, Andy Kellett, and I he and I have we go back a long, 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 long time, and we basically talk about primarily what there is to learn about recent happenings in the security world. So I started it back in 2011, 2012 timeframe when there was a lot of stuff happening in industry, like the Aurora attack had just happened. And, mm-hmm. and you know, at the time, I was just getting into podcasts. And it occurred to me, like, all the podcasts were especially in the security world, were like morning zoo radio shows.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, it just seemed like there was something missing. And a lot of them were very offensive focused, like, you know, mm-hmm. for pen testers, red teams, and which is all good stuff. I mean, they were very entertaining and I learned a bunch, no knock on them. But it struck me that there was something missing. Like, we weren't talking about how to defend networks better. And so that was something that I just, again, said on myself. And from a security perspective, like, that I think is also one of the things that helped me the most in my career was into getting to where I'm at right now. It forced me on a like daily basis to look at what has happened in the world and then kind of game out, well, what happened and, you know, what could have been done different. And by the way, for the most part, you never know what actually happened because, right. You know, it's, you get headlines and not a lot else. Sometimes you do get congressional hearings and you see the guts of what happened, but it's that analysis and hypothesizing and whatnot that I think, it's been both helpful to me, but also I think helpful to the listeners, because as I've heard from many of the listeners of the show, it's helped them to, you know, to form their way of thinking in how they think about security. So okay. Again, another awesome thing that I've been able to be part of.
Absolutely. So again, folks, go to Jerry's InfoSec.exchange profile. The link is in there for that podcast as well, and be sure to check it out. So as I mentioned, we are at time and then some. So, but Jerry, I mean, we could probably go on for who knows how long, but really appreciate you coming on the show. I think this has been a really good conversation. I personally can't thank you enough, and I'm seeing, you know, our viewers are thanking you as well for, you know, for building what has become a refuge for many of us and keeping that thing going. So
it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you. So with that, folks, we gotta let you go. Another great episode, another amazing guest, but we'll be back again with more guests in the future. You know, I've got a bunch lined up. I got some really cool guests coming up. Well, all my guests are amazing. But no, lots of good stuff on the horizon. So keep coming back. We'll keep letting you know when new shows are airing. We're here on the Wednesdays. You know the time, you know the place. Keep coming back for Security Bridges, and we'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Securing Bridges Podcast with Alyssa Miller. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSBmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.